Thank you for standing by. I would like to remind all parties today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect. Mr. Brooks, you may begin.
So, good morning. I'd like to welcome everyone to the 8th anniversary charm presentation. This is the first of two charm presentations, and today we're going to be hearing from Drs. Bonnie Burati of JPL and Dr. Jeff Cuzzi of NASA Ames. As I mentioned before, you can mute your own microphone by dialing *6 so that we avoid unwanted noise on the line. If you need to ask a question, you can dial *6 again, and please wait for the end of the individual presentations, and I will invite questions from the audience at that point in time. So I wanted to give you a brief introduction to our speakers for the day. We will be starting off with Dr. Bonnie Burati of JPL. Her primary interest research is into the is in volatiles, largely in the outer solar system, looking at how these volatiles get transferred to and from the various surfaces out there, looking at the composition and the nature and the distribution of such volatiles, and also looking into the possible existence of ice on the moon. I know she's been involved in some of that. She's received her PhD from Cornell. She's currently the VIMS investigation scientist. She's also involved in the Dawn mission, the Clementine mission to the moon, Deep Space One, as well as New Horizons, in addition to Cassini and probably a couple of others that I've neglected to mention. And she'll be speaking today regarding Cassini investigations over the past year into the icy satellites of Saturn. Next, we'll be hearing from Dr. Jeff Cuzzi, who is at NASA Ames. His primary interest research interests involve planetary rings, looking at theoretical and observational studies of ring material, ring structure, and how the rings are formed and maintained. And he also does some dabbling in the formation of planetesimals and understanding how solar systems form and the early stages thereof. He received his PhD from Caltech. He was the ring subgroup leader of the Voyager imaging team and helped the planning of that mission through the Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune encounters. He is also the interdisciplinary scientist for planetary rings on the Cassini-Huygens mission at Saturn, and he's also the 2010 Gerard P. Kuiper Prize recipient. With that, I guess I should ask if there are any questions up front from anyone in the audience, any issues of clarification. And if not, I would like to invite Bonnie to begin her presentation regarding the icy satellites and what's been going on for the past year or so.
Okay, thanks so much, Sean. Can everybody hear me all right? I guess so. Okay, I want to thank everyone for dialing in. I have a presentation here, which I'm outlining the major discoveries over the last year. I've picked this mainly from the satellite group that I run on for Cassini, and also some of my favorites. I've added, it has kind of my slant to it. Okay, on slide number 2, you have a list of the summary of the targeted flybys. Let me, though, emphasize that targeted flybys are just one of the aspects of our observations. I'll be talking about half the time about flybys that have that or data that doesn't come from targeted flybys. So we had, during the past year, 6 targeted flybys of Enceladus. 3 of them were maps, and there's some very interesting observations that are coming out of those flybys, not just about the composition of the plume, but I was just talking to Frank Crary last week, and he said that 2 of the instruments, he's the PI on CAPS, and there are some other MAPS instruments that can't agree on the number of free electrons. It's anywhere from a fraction of a percent to maybe 5% or more. This has to do with free electrons, whether or not they're attached to dust or whether they're just, you know, out there all by themselves. There were 2 very unique flybys that occurred. There was our first radar SAR flyby of Enceladus, and we also had a double occultation from UVIS, where 2 stars in Orion's belt were occulted by the plume of Enceladus. We also have the amazing fact that VIMS detected heat on a thermal signature on heat during E18. during the D3 flyby, which was primarily a gravity flyby to understand whether or not Dione is differentiated and what its interior looks like. The MAPS people analyzed some data from D1 to E3 to discover a very thin atmosphere of carbon dioxide and oxygen on Dione, previously CAPS discovered ionized O2. Okay, so slide number 3 just gives an overview of the highlights I'm going to be discussing. One, activity on Dione, the double occultation by UVIS of the Enceladus plumes, the first high-resolution radar SAR, that side-looking radar, the heat detected by VIMS on Enceladus, some pretty cool small satellite observations, Pac-Men, that slang that we use for this interesting feature we found on Tethys and Mimas, and Roger Clark has a theory on the on what causes the colors of the satellites. He sent me a slide. And some of the small satellite observations. Oh, I'm sorry, I have that twice. Sorry about that. Hyperion and Iapetus campaigns, and also the plumes galore, the plumes that we have been observing. This is an example of untargeted observations for the most part. And finally, a couple of nuggets on the MAPS observations. So here on slide 4, I just show kind of a typical image of Dione that was returned recently. Now, we don't really have a targeted optical remote sensing flyby of Dione. But here's one that we got serendipitously on the MAPS, the RSS MAPS flyby. And now MAPS refers to the fields and particles, if you're not aware of that acronym. Sorry if I use too many acronyms. I'll try not to. And you can see just this one image shows this intriguing, looks like a fault almost that extends down the middle of the image. On slide 5, I've summarized the reasons why we think there might be activity on Dione, either currently or in the recent past. There are just multiple lines of evidence, which include, first of all, the tenuous atmosphere by multiple instruments. I mean, that could be created by micrometeorite bombardment or accretion from the E-ring, but it does seem to be more than that, that perhaps there's some kind of slow outgassing. There's also some observations primarily from the magnetometer that there seems to be a atmosphere or plume that is altering the fields and particles environment. It's kind of just pushing against the environment, similar to the one on Enceladus. And analysis, several teams have done an analysis of that, and it's a fraction of 1%, about, I think, 0.5% of what the plume on Enceladus is believed to be. I think that's probably the most compelling evidence for current activity. But also we see on Dione, we see these paleo tiger stripes, similar to the tiger stripes we see on Enceladus. Some of those look like they've been active in the past. Those are especially prominent at the South Pole. And also, there's highly crystalline ice, which suggests recent heating. And finally, there are these possible cryovolcanoes. On slide number 6 here, I show an example of one of these. This is some work that Paul Shank has been doing. If you look on the left there, right in the middle, smack in the middle, there's like this double feature. It looks like a double crater, but in fact, I kind of blow it up there in a couple of Paul's images. He's done these, showing that, in fact, it is not a crater, but really some kind of a volcanic feature. And on the left there, if you look at a big circle around that putative volcanic feature, it seems to be very smooth, as if some effluvia, some ice particles or something that came out of that volcano possibly just kind of rained down, kind of snowed on the surface. So we see that very smooth surface compared to the other heavily cratered regions. And finally there on the left, you see what's known as a rampart crater, which the reason that this rampart, this wall, is built around this crater is that water underneath, water ice, does melt when an impact occurs. And for that to happen, it would have to be kind of almost semi-liquid already. So there's kind of some intriguing evidence, but we don't really have the smoking gun. So moving on to this other, I think one of the most spectacular observations during the last year was E15, the 15th targeted flyby, in which the ultraviolet experiment observed the dimming of two stars in Orion's belt. There were Epsilon Orionis and Zeta Orionis. And it was a successful observation, and Candy Hansen and her colleagues are analyzing this data to yield the vertical structure of the plume, to measure variability, and to pin down the collimation of the gas in the jets. This will enable us to understand how the jets are created. Candy is still working on this data as we speak. On the lower right there of slide number 7, I have an image of Enceladus that was taken by ISS during the exit. During these when we have an occultation or a map flyby, we always get serendipitous images of Enceladus. So moving on to slide 8, what I think is the most really another spectacular observation that we got during targeted flyby. This was a dedicated radar flyby. This is the first time we have gotten close in. This was about 500 kilometers. It was so close that we had to be on thrusters. We had to, not only because it was close, but we had to control the spacecraft. The pointing is very important with this side-looking radar. And the goals of this observation were both to compare an object with known composition, which Enceladus is, the surface is mainly water ice, to Titan data, because we're really not sure what the composition of Titan is. And also, this was the first close radar passage of an icy satellite. So during this observation, we also got some plume observations. Sears was monitoring the heat. We also got some images of Dione. And finally, ISS is doing a Lagrangian satellite search at Enceladus and Rhea. We haven't found any yet, but they're looking. So slide number 9 shows our observational plan. What I'm going to show is the results from that, the red things on the bottom. We weren't actually able to get the orange scans. We didn't have enough hydrazine, enough fuel on the spacecraft, but we got data on the blue X's and those images down there on the lower right. If you look on slide number 10, there, in fact, is the radar data superimposed on the imaging data. And it seems to the features seem to line up closely, but the major observation is that the radar reflectivity of Enceladus is very, very high. It really is, you know, is the highest thing in the solar system. And the preliminary analysis from the radar team is that there's only one phenomenon that can cause this to occur, and that's this thing called coherent backscatter, which is a multiple scattering effect. Somehow the multiply scattered photons, and now these are radar photons, line up and are reflected back to the observer in phase coherently. You get this really, really large radar backscatter. So they're still working on that, but preliminary results are going to be presented at the AGU meeting in the fall and the BPS meeting. So let me move on to the results, another spectacular result from one of our targeted Enceladus flybys, and that was the VIMS observation. This is work that Jay Gogan and his colleagues have been doing. And here's a nugget that we submitted to the project earlier. And basically, we have detected a thermal signature from VIMS before, from a previous observation in August of 2010. But this one was really spectacular. If you look at on the left image there, that shows the spacecraft track as it this observation only took about a minute and a half. And that is the sub-observer point on the spacecraft being dragged across the South Pole. And VIMS was able to obtain spectra at each of those points. And what this shows is an extraction of, I don't know, about 20 spectra from where that little arrow, that red arrow is. And if you look on that spectral line in the middle there, there is one spectrum that looks like it's much brighter. So it's in that middle column, it says spectra from 3 to 5 microns. And right in the middle where that large red line is, you can see it's brighter. That is the thermal signature of those at the tiger stripe there. And preliminary analysis by Jay shows that Enceladus is emitting from very small regions. In this case, it's less than 90 kilometers and emits at least 20 kelvins. And here on the right side, we show the spectra. So the middle one, the bright one, shows that thermal signature. That's why the dots go up. But the point before and after are cool, showing that these spots from which Enceladus emits is very, very small. Okay, moving on to some other what I think are really interesting observations of the small satellites. Now, we have the Cassini project has tried to get a wide variety. You know, there's a whole family of small satellites in the Saturnian system that are often neglected, and we've attempted to get representative at least one close-up of each of the major small satellites, and we got two of them in 2011. The first one I show there is Janus. Now, this is the so-called co-orbital satellite. Janus and Epimetheus orbit right outside the main ring system, and every 4 years they change their orbits. It's believed that they were once the same object, but a collision caused them to separate, and they changed their orbits. And before, we actually have watched that happen on Cassini, a spectacular photo opportunity. But what we got here on March was a 28,000-kilometer close-up of Janus, and you can see it is a highly cratered object. It's very rough and cratered. Now, in contrast, we were able to get an observation of Methone. It was actually a satellite that was found by Cassini in 24, shortly after the orbital mission began, and it dwells between the orbits of Mimas and Enceladus. It's a small satellite, but if you look at the surface of it in this high-resolution image, this is at about 45 kilometers away, it is exceedingly smooth. So contrast that with Janus, and we don't know why that is true. One theory is that it's smooth because it accretes ice particles from the E-ring. The collisional environment there, you know, is probably not as extreme as, you know, right next to the main ring system, but as you can see, whatever craters have happened have been smoothed over, and we believe that might be due to the E-ring. It's kind of really the contrast here is very marked, very marked. Okay, moving on to, how am I doing on time? Let's see.
Doing great, Bonnie.
Okay, try to wrap this up because I do want to save some opportunity for questions. Okay, so one of the really significant, most significant discoveries of this mission have been done by SIRS. I mean, SIRS was the first instrument to observe the activity on Dione. It was observed indirectly by the MAPS instruments, but the hotspot was discovered by SIRS. And lo and behold, when SIRS looked at Mimas, it saw this other thermal anomaly. Here, this wasn't discovered last year, but I just give this as way of review. On slide 13, entitled Pac-Man on Mimas, we call it the Pac-Man because it kind of looks like a Pac-Man. But that, in the upper left here, that is the theoretical energy, the theoretical temperature that would occur on Mimas if everything was in thermal balance. But if you look at the actual map, it shows that most of the heat is on the other side, the wrong side of the moon. So there is a model that Paul Schenck and the SIRS team, led by Carly Howitt and John Spencer, have come up with that this blue part here, this anomalously cool region, is actually cool because of high-energy electrons bombard that hemisphere and anneal the particles there to cause a thermal, to change the thermal conductivity. So that's the model that they've come up with. And lo and behold, there is evidence that this is the case from MAPS instruments, which show there is, in fact, a flux of high-energy electrons on that side, that cool side of Mimas. Now, Carly Howitt just sent me this image, which is from a paper she submitted. This is slide number 14. That shows a similar Pac-Man, not as pronounced, but there's a similar Pac-Man on Tethys. And again, the cause may be the alteration of the surface by high-energy electrons. The pattern seems to line up with where the coolest regions are, where the flux of high-energy electrons is the most extreme. You can see the Pac-Man is facing in the other direction. And here in slide number 15, this is in a publication from Paul Schenck, who's used a whole bunch of ISS images of various colors to make some color maps. And if you look on this map on slide 15, an albedo map, it's actually a color map, there is a bluish tinge centered around that big crater, which is called Herschel. And that, in fact, lines up with the cool region. And this bluish tinge is believed to be caused by high-energy electrons bombarding the surface. There was also a paper that Amanda Hendricks and her colleagues came out with showing that E-ring deposition on Mimas is important as well. This is based on UVIS and VIMS data. So it's all kind of, you know, there's multi-instrument capability here to try to understand why Pac-Men exists on at least Mimas and Tethys. So let me move on to another campaign that we successfully executed during the past year. Now, in the Solstice mission, there are no targeted flybys of Iapetus or Phoebe because they're so far out, it takes too much fuel to get out there. However, there were a few campaigns. There were a few times when these objects appeared less than a million kilometers, and we were able to get some I skipped a slide here. Just park that thought for a minute. One of the campaigns, the slide, getting back to slide number 16, one of the campaigns that Tillman Denk has been leading is to understand the rotational states of the outer irregular satellites. These are the families of satellites captured Kuiper Belt objects, small Kuiper Belt objects, of which Phoebe is the largest one, that are way far distant from Saturn. They're like, you know, a tenth of an astronomical unit, which is about 15 million kilometers out there. They're really far out. And these objects have been subjected to a very kind of a tumultuous collisional environment, and they're highly collisionally involved. So one of the basic facts that Tillman and his colleagues are uncovering is what is the rotational state of these objects? And he's been gathering this data during off times and has actually obtained this data here, which I've listed the very, I can't pronounce most of these satellites' names. They're named after various ice gods of the Nordic races. But Tillman has done a really admirable job of collecting these rotational states. And as you can see, they're quite different, implying that they're very collisionally evolved. So he's working on that. And okay, so back to the campaigns we had in Iapetus and Hyperion. As I said, there were no targeted flybys. We were able to get observations of the serendipitous observations of both Iapetus and Hyperion. Now, remember, Hyperion was that spongy-like object, which we saw at less than 100,000 kilometers. And we got some views that we didn't get of the one targeted flyby we had in, I think it was 2005. So we got some new data. And also with Iapetus, we got a pretty good view of the South Pole there under, I mean, this is better than a Voyager flyby. And we haven't analyzed the data yet, but, you know, they're on the website, the sarin.jpl.nasa.gov. They're there for everyone to look at, and it's quite spectacular data. Okay, now, we have made many plume observations during the extended mission and the Cassini Solstice mission, and there are two teams that are working on competing theories to try to understand the origin of activity on Enceladus, which is monitored by the plumes. So there's two major models. One is tidal heating that Terry Herford and his co-workers are looking at, and shear heating. This is Carolyn Porco and I think Francis Nimmo and their colleagues are working on. So that's good. We have competing theories, and that's how science marches forward. No definitive answer on that. Roger Clark has a model that he's just submitted for publication. I think it actually has been accepted, in which he thinks, and this is the details are here on this slide number 19, which the color, there's, you know, the satellites are mainly composed of water ice, but there are contaminants. And he believes that the color and the non-ice component is nano iron, and has done some spectral modeling in which he's added he's taken laboratory measurements and added this nano iron to the ice to replicate the spectra of the rings, Dione, Phoebe, and Iapetus. It's a pretty good match. And finally, there were a couple of important MAPS observations and results over the past year. Jared Leisner and his colleagues have a paper that I believe just has been accepted, in which he has observed auroral hiss and electron beams from Enceladus. These have appeared in all the flybys of Enceladus from NASS, and they seem to be clustered in two regions around the moon. These arrows here on page 20 seems to be the regions from where the auroral hiss and electron beams originate. Finally, there is an interesting observation from Coleman and his co-workers that there are not only Van Allen-type belts at Saturn, but all the moons seem to be carving out a cavity in this charged particle environment. This is proton radiation that is similar to the Earth's Van Allen belts, and these belts are produced from cosmic rays hitting Saturn's atmosphere. So those are cavities in the Van Allen belt that those moons produce. And that is all I had, the summary. It doesn't cover everything, but these are results I got from team members and also from things that I've kind of cherry-picked through the results from the last year. So I'd like to entertain questions that people may have.
So, Bonnie, I want to thank you for a really great and very thorough summary. And I'll take the moderator's advantage here and just kick off with one question because you just discussed it. These Van Allen belts that you just described, are these thought to be related to, or this is sort of the same sort of phenomenon that's responsible for creating the Pac-Man? Is this sort of the same underlying thing?
I don't think so. I think that this, the Van Allen, I'm not an expert in magnetospheric stuff, but I think that these are mainly proton bombardments that come from cosmic rays. And the electrons, I think, are, as I understand it, are more from maybe Saturn or created from material that comes from the satellite. I mean, the electrons, and of course, I think that there would have to be energy balance of some sort. So, you know, maybe the protons and the electrons kind of, you know, balance each other in the electrical, you know, sense. But I think that they are separate phenomena.
Okay, if anyone else has any questions, just sort of, you know, announce yourself and fire away.
This is Tim Cassidy Curtis, Solar System Ambassador. Is anybody conjecturing an undersea ocean vis-a-vis Europa for Enceladus?
Yeah, it is highly likely that both Europa and Enceladus have undersea oceans, but the evidence is actually different. In the case of Europa, it is the fact that it tends to hold the magnetic field of Jupiter. And as far as we know, the theoretical arguments that you really have to have a liquid to do that. So there's very good evidence. There's also geologic evidence on the surface. We see rafting and all that sort of thing. On Enceladus, the thinking is much different. There's some work. There's a number of pieces of evidence. One of them is that the jets are collimated and come out too fast. That can only be the only way that can be done is if it comes out from a water liquid source. There's also seems to be some salt particles in the plume particles. The water ice is salty, and that can only come if you have a liquid ocean in contact with a mantle that has salts in it. So yes, there's very good evidence on both Enceladus and Europa that there's a subsurface liquid ocean.
So, same conclusion, but different observations.
Exactly. There, we haven't detected a magnetic field or, you know, an entrainment at Enceladus yet. But Enceladus does tend to, it tends to warp the magnetic field and the particles, it kind of drapes the particle field, magnetic field of Saturn over itself. This is how, this is a magnetometer observation that led to the discovery of the plumes.
When I spoke to a Europa investigator some years back, I asked how would he feel if a seismometer could be put on Europa. He said he'd get really excited about that because that would give him a whole lot of information. Would a seismometer on Enceladus be just as exciting for you guys?
Yeah, we'd love it. I mean, one of the issues here is how thick is the crust? You know, on Europa, we think it's, I don't know, between like 2 and 10 kilometers. You don't have a very good feel, and it's also the same on Enceladus. We also don't know how large the ocean is. Does it cover the whole, is it subsurface, you know, the whole globe, or is it local? Is it a pop? You know, there's just basic things that we don't know that, yeah, a seismometer would be great. It would really tell us. It would really enable us to probe the interior structure of the moon.
Good time for another question yet?
Yeah.
Hey, on Mimas, it was mentioned that the measured cooler areas was caused by high energy electron bombardment.
Yeah.
Why
yeah.
would that cool anything from a physics point of view?
Well, it increases the thermal conductivity because the particles are close together, and that enables you to transfer heat away faster.
You mean it does the surface might be acting more, the ice is acting more like a metal than the...
Exactly. Ice? That's a good analogy. Yeah, the conductivity is much higher when particles get annealed.
Yeah, 'cause I could give you better electrical conductivity, but I didn't know necessarily if it's a non-metal to begin with that it would cause a thermal conductivity.
Yeah, it is a non-metal, but I think that's a good analogy that it does. It just makes the part, it packs the particles closer together so that it enables heat to transfer much more efficiently.
Okay.
Or
thank
to transfer away more efficiently.
Thank you.
Do we know the source of the high energy electrons?
I believe it is the planet itself, Saturn itself. It ultimately comes from photochemical properties in the upper atmosphere of photochemical processes in the upper atmosphere. And there's some probably from the solar wind also, in addition.
Well, I also believe you get some generation just from the E-ring grains and its interaction with ultraviolet radiation coming in from the sun.
Yeah, exactly.
So with regard to the Pac-Man bunny, you know, you showed some really impressive data from Sears and from Carly. Do you know... Is SOS planning to do more such mapping, like to map the other hemisphere of those bodies to get the same kind of information?
Yeah, there are a couple of low-resolution flybys in the XXM, and then I believe there's one, an observation at least of Mimas, possibly of Tethys, I'd have to look it up, in the proximal orbits that we'd like to get. So, yeah, there are no more targeted flybys, but there are... opportunities that we have a couple of pies and then additional observations we'd like to get.
Okay, great. So if there are no more questions, I'd like to thank Bonnie again and to begin with Jeff's presentation on Saturn's rings and what's been done with those in the past year on Cassini. So take it away, Jeff.
Am I unmuted? No, let me try it again.
Yes, you are. We can hear you. Jeff, I think you may have muted yourself again.
You can hear me now, right?
Now I can hear you.
Okay. Okay, so this first image right on the title page is a very exciting one to us because it was one of the first images that we got of the rings after a long hiatus with the spacecraft lying in the equator plane. And I'll say more about that later, but it's... It's actually taken from the unlit face of the rings, and yet there's all these bright features. You can see this is mostly the A ring. The gap at the left is the Yankee gap, and it's got two little bright clumpy ringlets in it, and then that very bright thing around the perimeter is the F ring. This is a very high phase angle, so these are tend to be dust grains scattering light in the forward direction. So the next slide actually makes that a little bit more clear. This is a full view of the rings from the unlit base. And what you see is that the B ring, where most of the material is just so full of stuff that it blocks sunlight. You just don't see much coming from through most of it, especially in the very dense central region. But the C ring and the inside and the A ring, the Cassini division, are translucent so that you can see light coming through even from the unlit face of the rings. But, of course, the B-ring, just this is to drive it home, is really where all the mass is contained. In fact, we don't really even know yet how much mass is there. Next slide shows a more familiar view of the ring. It's a nice color composite for those of you who are new to this game. I imagine maybe there's someone. The three classical rings, the B ring has all this beautiful irregular structure that we really do not understand. The C ring in its outer part has a series of these bright plateau structures that we also do not understand, which sort of straddles a gap called the Maxwell gap that has a ringlet in it. And the A ring actually is a place where we actually do understand a lot of what we're seeing. There are resonances and spiral waves with the moons and stuff like that. And the F ring is a little strand, again, that you can barely see in this image. It lies, a couple thousand kilometers outside of the edge of the A ring. Okay, so enough for general perspective. I'm going to focus again on progress just this year. Big deal for us to be back out of the equator plane, or you can actually look at the rings again. I'm going to highlight a small number of things. The first three I'm going to cover in a little bit of detail, the idea that we have objects in the rings called propeller objects that move around. I'm going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about the F-ring, and this very complicated structure is caused by embedded objects, most of which we haven't seen, but we see their effects. I'm going to talk about composition, connects a little bit to several things that Bonnie said. And then at the end, I'm going to hit on single slide each on a number of very interesting other topics that are new this year that I'm not going to have as much time to talk about. Okay, so next, we just want to emphasize, as the mission has gone on, even though we've been in the equator plane, Saturn and the Sun are continuing to evolve in their seasonal configurations, and here the black circle indicates where this year's coverage sort of lies. The Sun is now almost 15 degrees out of the equator plane, so the rings are well lit. That's the red line. The blue line shows the elevation the rings is seen from the Earth, which fluctuates because the Earth's orbit is a little inclined to the ecliptic.
Okay, so just, I'm sorry, Jeff, just for everyone out there, now we're on slide five.
Slide five, sorry. Okay, that's a good tip. Okay, so just so you can catch up, slide five shows where we are now in this year I'll be discussing in terms of the solar elevation angle, the red line, and the blue line, which is the Earth. Okay, of course, Cassini doesn't always observe from these angles, and slide six shows the mission phases that the blue part covers the time I'm going to be discussing, and the step curve shows the inclination of Cassini's orbit. So you can see over the left that term called EQ1. We've been sort of in Siberia from the ring standpoint for the last year and a half, sitting in the equator plane where we can't really see anything. But just toward the end of this year, we're up now at inclined orbits in this mission phase called IN1, which will last almost 2 years, and or maybe a little bit more than 2 years, in which we're going to get a lot of really exciting things. So this is the first presentation that just shows the beginning part of what we just started to learn in IN1. So this is actually one of the first pictures that came back. We're happy to see it, and it basically highlights the F-ring over here toward the outside, and again the dark gap is the Encke gap in the A-ring, and you can actually see a little moonlit pan in there and some of its wavy ringlets. But the outer part of the A-ring, pretty much all this region here, especially the region, pretty much all this region here is what I want to talk about next. That's to do with the objects called propellers, which are seen pretty much only in the outer part of the A-ring. And as we go across the top series of images, we show the rings, the outer part of the A-ring, little tiny structures you can barely see in the middle top picture, which enlarge into these little noisy double-dash structures, which really don't look very exciting at all. But what they reveal is the disturbance in the rings caused by an object that might be only a couple of hundred meters across, far too small to see directly. But the bottom panel shows model predictions of what we're going to, what we think we're seeing there, and they have this kind of propeller look to them, so that's why we refer to these things as propeller objects. And the next slide actually, and basically what this means is the object is gravitationally deflecting particles that approach it from further from Saturn and closer to Saturn in different directions, and their orbits then get excited and they sort of clear out this sort of propeller-shaped region. Next picture actually gives you more of an intuitive concept that we're talking about here. This is slide 9, the outer A-ring, and you can just see there are just flocks and flocks of these things all through the outer A-ring, too many to really, you know, count them all, but we measure them in spots and we do statistics, we have size distributions and all this kind of stuff. We know they don't contain a lot of mass, but they certainly are a fascinating population, and we don't know, for instance, if they are leftover remnant of the moon that was destroyed to form the rings, or if they're something that's constantly forming and dissipating in the rings. What was discovered about a year or so ago on slide 10, actually, some of these that are outside the Yankee Gap are what we call giant propellers. That is, they're really big, and they're big enough to actually track individually going way, way back to 2006. So we can actually watch their orbital motion change by looking at the longitudes that we see them at. And the plot basically shows how it's a longitude residual, or it's an angular discrepancy from a smooth orbit for this particular one, which is the biggest propeller object. So basically it looks like it's varying in sort of a smooth way, and it was originally suggested on slide 11 that this was caused by a libration effect, that the object causes this gap, and it basically gets gravitationally influenced, and it sort of oscillates or wobbles back and forth in the angular direction between the two ends of the gap. This was a very appealing theory, but in the last year or so, as I discuss on slide 12, there are some weaknesses in that theory have emerged. That is, the ends of the gap would probably readjust and sort of damp out this oscillatory motion. So now several groups are looking more at more of a Brownian motion, kind of an effect where these propeller objects pass by large-ish things like just big ring particles or gravitational wakes, which are clumps of big ring particles that are common in the A-ring. And these guys just kind of scatter them around like gas molecules scatter a dust particle in the air, Brownian motion. Each kick is small, but they add up into this kind of random walk. And this is a little counterintuitive at first to imagine that this smoothish motion could be due to a random walk, but the theory does seem to at least allow it. And you can already see that there are places where the changes in the orbital motion are quite abrupt. It's not always smooth. So this is something that's being worked on right now by several groups. There are some implications of this for formation of planets, planetesimals, asteroids, and large objects in the solar nebula get kicked around by fluctuations in the nebula. So if we can understand this process going on in the rings, we'll understand planet formation a lot better. Okay, so actually, just a little tidbit, since we got back up out of the equator plane, we've reacquired a number of these propellers, and their motions continue to be weird and fluctuate. The panel on the left shows a really abrupt change in motion of one of them. So this actually may support the random walk more than the libration. But this is certainly going on, and we're going to do a lot more of it as we go through IN1 over the next couple of years. Okay, so I want to turn to the F-ring now. This is a funny reprojection of the F-ring with the planet removed and the radial scale enhanced and at a variety of different epochs done by Carl Murray. And what you see is first, it's got lots of little jaggedy wiggles all throughout, all around its circumference. You then notice occasional giant radial blasts or jets that occur at specific longitudes. And then as time goes on, you tend to see these spiral streaks, a little bit more smoothed out. They tend to go away from the F-ring. They tend to result from these jets, which are collisional events. And then in the bottom two on the right, or the two on the right and the bottom, you see what appears to be a second strand actually appearing that looks a little bit like the F-ring. And if you trace it back, it actually intersects with the F-ring at one particular longitude. So what's going on here? Okay, next slide shows a model by Carl Murray that we have. In association with the F-ring, we have a family of little moonlets, most of which we know are there, but we have not been able to track their orbits. They just change too fast. This one of the biggest, it was discovered all the way back in 2004, and the orbit is pretty well determined, and you can see that the location of this object, the symbols in the two left panels, corresponds pretty well in longitude with this jet. So we think that this one object just goes, which is on an eccentric orbit, and it goes crashing through the F-ring, and if it hits stuff, it just kicks up this big jet, which just gets sheared out in the azimuthal direction because this material all comes out with a range of different semi-major axis or orbital period. So it shears out, the more slowly moving stuff falls behind, the more rapidly moving stuff moves ahead. And eventually these shear out into one of these big spirals. But now this jet on slide 17, next slide, this big giant diagonal-looking jet was a really unusual version of this. This happened toward the end of 2007. Looks a lot like the F-ring, probably just because it has so much stuff in it. And I'll talk a little bit about these spikes later, but they're probably caused by little sort of, 100-meter objects that get excited and then they stir up the dust. After another 2 years, the bottom panel shows that the stuff in this jet or streak or strand has now spread out, and what you see at the bottom left is a line of little clumps that are probably little moonlets that are trying to form by just self-gravity, accreting themselves from the stuff in the strand. Now, when we got back to look at the F-ring after just recently, these clumps have pretty much gone away, though something has scattered them away, but the F-ring looks a little bit spikier than before. So that's a mystery that we're going to try to continue to unravel. But I want to talk about smaller objects. This is a new result from this year. If you look very closely through the F-ring core at high resolution, you see lots and lots of these little tiny streaks. Slide 18, sometimes they come in groups, as shown on the right. Sometimes they're all by themselves. These things go only maybe 100 or a couple of hundred kilometers from the F-ring core, not the 1,000 or so that there are 500 that these big strands go. Next slide shows a whole bunch more of these. They call these mini jets, and you can just see what they are. There are about maybe 15 of these at any given time as you go around in the F-ring. So this has actually been modeled as a much lower velocity impact onto some material in the F-ring core by a moonlet that's probably a lot smaller. Maybe it's 100 meters or even smaller. But these kinds of things are only produced if you hit it maybe only 10 meters per second or something like that. So pretty low velocity. And you can actually model them pretty well that way. So you can start to get at the statistics of the more embedded objects in the F-ring by looking at these things. Okay, so next slide. I just want to remind you, slide 20. This was one of the last slides that were taken before we went into Siberia mode. A giant jet happened in the F-ring. There's no real sign of anything happened on the way out, but we are continuing to look at it. And we have some speculative expectations that we might see more of these kinds of events in the years to come that I can say more about if somebody wants me to. Okay, so next slide. I want to move on to the composition a little bit. Bonnie mentioned the coloration of the satellites. There are actually two models, I believe, for the coloration of the satellites and the rings. I'm focusing more on the rings, but very likely it's the same colorant. The two models are the rust or nanometal idea that Roger has been advocating, as shown on the right. Mars is a good example of that. It's rusty. On the left, we illustrate there's another alternative, which is organic materials. PAHs, or polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, are also red. All these carbon ring models shown up at the top left, small carbon ring models, carbon ring molecules. Carrots, for instance, are red because of carotene, which is one of these. Bottom panel shows a bunch of others. So we really don't know yet which of these two colorants is affecting the rings and the moons. But the implications are obviously different. I mean, either you have metal in the rings and the moons, or you have organics in the rings and the moons. So it's important to unravel this. Next slide shows some spectra comparing the rings with some other icy objects in the solar system. Top panel is the rings, and the colored spectra are actually Triton in the green and something called Nibiru in the red. So you have these are TNOs, trans-Neptunian objects in the outer solar system that look at least vaguely like the rings. And then we have a panel showing the classical satellites. We have a little reddened spectrum at the very shortest wavelength that's much less extreme than the rings or these outer solar system objects. And then we have Iapetus and Hyperion, which have a qualitatively different look. They have a linear reddened spectrum all the way out from visible to 2 microns, which looks more like many of the outer solar system objects, such as Sedna, that is shown in the bottom panel. So, again, this is something we really don't completely understand, but we want to understand why some objects are only red out to 500 nanometers and why some objects are red all the way out to 2.5 microns. Is it the same stuff or not? So the next slide, which is slide 23, which is a somewhat complicated slide, shows some steps that are being taken in this direction. This is from Gianrico Falacchione. It's a 2D plot that compares the water ice abundance, which is shown horizontally as the band depth at 2 micron wavelength, one of those big water ice 2 micron bands shown in the previous slide. So more water rich to the right. The vertical axis shows the redness at short visible wavelengths from 0.3 to 0.35 to 0.55 microns, so redder as you go down. There's a sort of a centroid region with Rhea and Hyperion in the middle and in that circle. And then as you go to some of the inner classical moons, Mimas, Enceladus, and Tethys, you move off to the right, perhaps because these things are more crusted or frosted on their surface by E-ring pure icy material. That is in the direction of more ice and less red. So that is plausible. Then as you go to Iapetus down to the upper left, probably you're getting polluted by Phoebe dust, which is these red dots way up at the upper left. So you're probably mixing Phoebe dust on there. It's also making you less red and less icy, so just darker and flatter. But the rings go in an entirely different direction down to the right, and they're extremely red and also extremely water ice rich. Interestingly, Prometheus is somewhat like the rings. All the other small ring moons, Bonnie mentioned Janus. Janus is these red diamonds just right in the middle here with Rhea, Hyperion, and all that. And so is Epimetheus, although it's a slightly different location. Okay, but so there's a very different color property between some of these ring moons and other ring moons and the rings themselves. So what this process is or intrinsic material that drives the rings to this very, very different location in this space remains to be seen. Okay, so I'm going to try to get through the next couple slides pretty expeditiously, or just to let you know what's been going on. Next slide is slide 24. Very interesting new work from the UVIS. When you get a stellar occultation of the rings, not only can you get very fine radial structure, but from the point sample-to-sample variance in the brightness and how that deviates from Poisson statistics, you can get a sense of the size of the largest particle in the ring as first shown by Showalter and Nicholson, this upper plot illustrates that if you have a few large particles in the ring, you'll have a much larger variance than if you have many small particles. So the plot on the right, Josh Colwell, illustrates that several, like these green dots up here, these green pluses, are sort of in the outer part of the Cassini division and the inner part of the A-ring, and there's evidence for lots of big particles, whereas these red pluses that are just lying flat along the bottom of the plot are in the plateaus in the C-ring that I alluded to early on in the talk. And they seem to have very few large particles. So this is very, very interesting stuff, and it's being followed up on right now. Another new result this year was this so-called predator-prey model. Arias Rosito came up with a model analogous to what you find when, say, a predator population like mountain, like lynx can eat up all the rabbits, and then the lynx all die of hunger, and then the rabbits come roaring back, and then the lynx come roaring back. And this is actually an oscillating pattern that's been observed over 100 years in Canada. And so Larry's idea is that you see something like that in the outer A-ring, that you form a batch of big objects by compression of ring orbits due to a moon, and these things stir up the surrounding material, which then eats them up, and they go away, and the whole cycle repeats. So it's kind of an interesting result, which I have to move on from. To the next slide, slide 26. Shows that the Sears team is starting to make some progress here on measuring the temperature, how the temperature of the rings varies. The upper curve shows how the rings cool down as the sun goes to its edge-on configuration. And the bottom panel shows how the ring particles heat up and cool down as they go into eclipse. And they've been able to model this with a dense ring that is not, the particles are not widely separated. So the ring has a volume density of about 20%, which is close to what we think is the case. And the ring particles themselves have this thermal inertia that Bonnie alluded to in respect to the Pac-Man. Thermal inertia is a measure of how conductive and insulating the particles are. So the particles, actually, the thermal inertia is moderately normal, and that seems to fit pretty well. Okay, next slide, slide 27, is my last slide, and this actually shows something somewhat different. This is the E-ring, which is a very giant, broad, diffuse ring centered on Enceladus, almost certainly due to ice particles being dented out of Enceladus from the jets and then spreading off in different directions. These tiny ice particles are strongly influenced by both charged, they get charged and then they get influenced by the magnetic field that influences their orbit, and sunlight also influences their orbits. So what we find here is that over the last couple of years, when the sun has been shining on the southern face of the ring has acquired this sort of bowl shape, where on both sides it is in the south, closer to the planet, and in the north, further from the planet, as seen in the cartoon at the bottom, and as seen in the cross-sectional images toward the right. If you also notice in the images that there's sort of a dark band going through vertically in the center of the ring, this is because these particles get scattered by Enceladus after they get emitted away from the equator plane. Okay, so they get emitted and they get scattered around, and you see this configuration. Okay, so I think I will wrap it up at this point. That's all. Thanks a lot.
Great, Jeff. Thanks a lot. There was a lot in there and a lot of interesting stuff. So, again, I'm going to take the moderator's privilege and poke at you a little bit on the nature of the contaminant and the rings, and discussing the competing ideas about this being organic material versus nanohematite. If it turns out, what are the implications for being nanohematite? Would this have to be intrinsic material? Could you rule it out? This being stuff coming in from micrometeoroids and that kind of thing?
That is probably the biggest problem with nanohematite, is the iron, getting the iron in there without getting the silicates that we know are very rare in the ring. Of course, you don't need much of this stuff. But getting iron without getting silicate is tough because iron does tend to go along with silicate cosmogonically. It's in the meteorites, it's in the asteroids. You know, there is no source of pretty much pure iron, and you know, CDA has looked not seen this. So that getting that to be the situation would strain our explanatory powers. Volatility, from the standpoint of volatility, from the standpoint of solubility, it's a little bit hard. It would almost have to be extrinsic rather than intrinsic. The organic could be intrinsic because from the standpoint of volatility, from the standpoint of solubility, it's a lot closer to water ice.
So the silicates have been definitively ruled out.
Well, at a certain level. At a certain level. This goes way back to microwave observations, interferometry, and single dish work that happened all the way back in the 80s. That's still our best constraint on how much total silicates there are in the rings, not just in the little surface layer, but all throughout the material, you know, and it's different depending on who you believe. It's certainly, you know, less than 10%, maybe less than 1%. So you take that, and then that's basically all your non-icy material. So now you take that and you say, all right, cosmogonically, how much of all this non-icy material can be hematite or iron? And I think it might turn out to be a stretch. I haven't done the models.
I don't know if you can tell, but I would kind of agree with you on this one. But one last follow-up on this. Is it possible that you've got a little bit of both?
Well, it's always possible. It's always possible. I think the idea of extrinsic pollution, there are models of that. And, you know, you can take a pretty credible outer solar system crud, which is actually 30% carbon, 30% silicate, and 30% ice, and you can darken, and you can end up darkening the C-ring and the Cassini division pretty much the way you see it. You don't get much out of the B-ring and the A-ring, though. So, but that stuff is not red. It's just black or gray. Almost certainly there's some of that, right? There is some of that, and whether or not the tiny amount that you get can be, I don't know if you can segregate enough iron and make it into hematite. I mean, there is a big oxygen atmosphere around the rings. This actually attracted me to this hematite idea in the first place. If you started with metal, you could oxidize it to hematite. I mean, that ring atmosphere is O and O2. So, you know, there are parts of that that are intriguing, for sure. And I have no doubt that there's some of each there. But I think you'd want to try to make a consistent story both with the rings and the classical moons, and even, you know, as I showed you, in the TNOs.
That's a really good point about the oxygen atmosphere. So I'm going to back off and invite other people to pose their own questions.
But the propellers, you've seen changes in longitude. Are you guys yet observing any changes in radius on them, moving inwards, moving outwards?
Oh, the propellers. It's very hard to measure the change in radius because, you know, the navigation, the images, the change in radius that is associated with these changes in longitude is like meters. So it's just very, very hard to see, whereas, you know, a change of radius in meters gives you a change in your angular motion, which when then you integrate it up over, you know, years, can give you a change in longitude of a few degrees. So that turns out to be the most sensitive way to measure the change in the radius that you can't really see directly.
Okay, any other questions?
I guess follow-up on that is, can the propellers get used as a some sort of a tool for possibly estimating or getting a handle on age of the rings or evolution of particles and orbits in the rings?
Maybe. One thing we might be able to do, these random walk theories do depend on the mass density of the rings and the size of the largest particles in the rings. So you might be able to, if you could convince yourself this is what's going on, it might give us another handle on particle size or ring mass density. In terms of the age, if they are just wandering around, then there's no particular tendency of them to move in one direction or another, so they're sort of in place. I mean, that flock hasn't necessarily moved systematically inwards or outwards based on any of these theories. People have looked at, there was this idea called type 1 migration that applies to planetesimals in the solar nebula, which says that these things move in one direction, let's say outwards, but the recent work that's been done suggests that maybe that goes on, but it's really, 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 really slow. So more or less, they're just probably random walking around in place.
Any indication of those propellers casting shadows back when the equinox occurred?
Yes. Actually, that one slide I showed of that one giant propeller, Blériot, you can very clearly see it as a vertical structure. So it's got, you know, a bright side and a dark side and a shadow. No doubt about that at all.
So if a spacecraft went back to Saturn 20 years from now, would it find them again, or would it find a whole batch of new ones?
Well, I'm just guessing. I'm guessing that these giant propellers probably have a lifetime longer than 20 years, and I'm guessing we'd find these guys. Although, if we didn't have any observations for 20 years, it might be a little tough to identify them again. I think what I heard from Matt Tiscarino was when we picked up these guys only after a year and a half of not seeing them. Some of them were, you know, 5 or 6 degrees away from our best guess as to where we might be. So if we didn't see them for 20 years, it might be a little hard to say, well, this one was that one. But probably they would be there about the thousands and hundreds of thousands of smaller ones. Your guess is as good as mine. It's like the flowers on the hillside. You come back next year and there's still flowers on the hillside, but they're not the same flowers.
Yeah.
Okay, so if there are no more questions, then I would like to thank Jeff again. I'd like to thank Bonnie as well. This was the first half of the Anniversary Charm Telecon, so I would like to invite everyone back in about a month's time, where we will have people. We will have Andy Ingersoll talking about Saturn's atmosphere, and Elizabeth Turtle, Ziggy Turtle, talking about Titan. And I think that's about it, and I guess we can adjourn.